Ken here. In nearly all of our podcasts, you hear students asking questions and their interaction with me. Many listeners find these exchanges illuminating because what is being asked is often exactly what is on their minds. If you find these conversations helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can maintain and expand our website. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, A Trackless Path 2, Part 8.
Sunday, August the 6th, right? 8th. I got the month right this time. A Trackless Path 2, Evening Session. I believe we still have a few questions to take up. Yeah, I ran into this in the teacher development program, which I did a couple of years ago. It's a 3-year program. And one person in the program decided he was there to learn. So he just volunteered and asked for every role play or exercise and asked questions, etc. The others just sat around like dead frogs on a dead log.
Slight exaggeration.
It all depends where you were sitting. And I would make rude noises about this from time to time. And finally, they decided to gang up on me. And so next time, they didn't tell me they were ganging up on me, but they got tired of my making rude noises about this. So the next time I said, and who would like to volunteer for this exercise? They all went, chew! Everybody. I went, oh. And totally changed the dynamic. Because whereas before I had to choose who was going to participate, but I had to be very careful now, is this person too delicate, and is this there, and oh, that was really tricky. But now with everybody going, choo, everybody had indicated they were willing in the same way as in the Dakini meditation, right? So now I could just, oh, this person will be the best for this exercise. I just made everything much easier and just changed the energy of the whole thing completely. Wouldn't you agree, Claudia?
Yes.
Thank you. Now, I say, if you got any questions, everybody goes, no. You know, occasionally somebody puts up a hand, things like that. So, you know, so I just said, okay, we're going to go around with the microphone. And everybody has these really great questions. And when they're put these questions out, you know, you notice the level of interest. You know, everybody just sitting there, oh, another boring question. It's not happening, right? So, with that, Gary.
Okay, you asked for it. I have two questions.
Music to my ears.
The first one deals with the morning recording that I'm partially responsible for losing. So, if
you were the guilty.
I am. I'm guilty. So if anybody out there is upset, just make it to northeastern New Mexico. I'll give you a few days head start. And in that, I remember you saying something about longing and pain and joy. And what intrigued me was how you described pain. You didn't mention it the same way you did today. And you described pain as the expression of separation. That's my first question. And the second question.
What's the question?
Just one at a time?
Okay. Just check, what's the question?
Well, the question is, what did you mean by the pain of separation? Because separation is a very general word, and of course, it can mean a lot of things to a lot of people.
Well, I think there are probably multiple meanings that could be brought in here. So I'll mention two, but there may well be others. We have a sense where we want to go. Or, to put it differently, we have a sense of how we want to be. Or, to put it in still other words, this is a little more difficult, but and possibly a little more doubtful. We have a sense of another possibility. I think that's the... And we may not know what it is, even if we have an idea of what it is, which is usually wrong, but that's another matter. We may have no idea how to get there. And so we feel a pain of separation. That's one level. Why do we desire things? Because we feel separate from them. And so that's another level. That the way that we ordinarily experience the world, it's as if there's a glass wall. And we can't quite touch what is on the other side of the glass. And not initially, but as our practice develops depth and we become more attuned to the possibilities of connection, then that sense of separation becomes more and more acute. That help?
A little bit. The title of this retreat is A Trackless Path. So,
A Trackless Path 2.
Well,
you don't want to confuse it with the first one.
I think there's a little bit of a problem in the title because you're not supposed to repeat things twice, right? Anyway,
no, well, okay. Fair enough.
If it's trackless. But the you've talked about willingness quite a bit. I mean, I've heard you talk about willingness. And when you talk about a pain of separation, for me that's something I would naturally avoid, glass wall or not. And so...
Now, you would avoid the pain of separation?
Well, in my own experience, that brings up a lot of obstacles. This whole thing of desiring something you feel separate from, if you get my drift. The whole thing is, it's like getting what you don't want and, you know, not getting what you want. That whole...
You're making some interesting jumps here.
I know, I am.
Okay.
So, when I hear you mention that, it sounds a little academic to me, because if you have willingness to engage something that's painful, even though you don't know where it's going to lead, then how does faith enter into that sense that you're talking about?
Just say that last, say the sentence of the question again, please. I want to.
I'm not sure I can repeat it. If one needs willingness to engage that pain that comes from longing, a pain of separation.
Okay.
Then how does, and you don't really know what's going to happen, because part of what I've heard you mention is really it's not something you can control, longing. then how does faith enter into this sense you're talking about?
Well, it seems this takes us right back to refuge. Now, there are two ways of looking at refuge. There's the classical interpretation of refuge, in which you, which is based on the metaphor of feudal society, where you had the warlord in the castle who protected the peasants, and so you hooked up with the mightiest, which just happens to be Buddha, of course. And that's a very straightforward interpretation, and it appeals to sense of insecurity, etc., etc. But that's not the one that I think is relevant here. A second interpretation of refuge is you become a refugee. Now, why does one become a refugee? One becomes a refugee because the circumstances of one's country have become intolerable. It may be personally intolerable, so you're fleeing some kind of persecution or a political witch hunt or something like that. Or it may have become maybe some disaster. It may have struck, like an earthquake or famine, disease. And maybe others. But the key factor in becoming a refugee is that for whatever reason, life as you've known it is no longer possible. And so you leave. When you leave, even if you have an idea where you may be going to, you know, another country, you really have no idea what's going to happen, how things are going to turn out. May even be worse. You have no idea. And that's where faith enters the picture. Because becoming a refugee requires being willing to meet whatever one experiences. Where you are isn't working. You start to go somewhere else. And you're just going to meet whatever you experience, which is how I view faith, as you know. So, for many people, I won't say for all, but for many people, practice is motivated, or it says, move away from the word practice, a spiritual path of some kind, is motivated by not being able to stand how things are for them right now. No longer being able to live with it. And so they embark on some kind of quest or path or whatever you want. Most of the time, probably all of the time, having no idea what's going to happen. That requires faith. But it's impelled by, I think, in most cases, some kind of longing. and the longing is sufficiently acute that a person addresses it in this perhaps somewhat radical way. Does that help?
Yes, and now for the second question, because I think what you just mentioned may lead to the next one, surprisingly. I was lucky enough to be given refuge by you here maybe a few summers ago. Are you planning to also offer that to folks here who may want that? That's why you shouldn't ask me to question.
Huh.
I told you shouldn't ask me to take the mic.
I didn't have any plans to.
Can you tell us why?
What are you hunting for here, Gary? And just leave the mic on, it's better.
Okay,
it crashes on
the it's the old lineage question. It seems that
okay.
Yes.
All right.
And there's you know, that's tends to stick with me a little bit. Because things have changed, haven't they?
He said, grinning seraphically. Need to put that in so that people listening can know the expression on your face. Well, I may have to get back to you on this one, but let me sit with it for a moment. I think it's because I want people to hold lineage in their hearts. Okay? Hi, Jeff.
Speaking of vows. The other night you mentioned...
Pardon?
The other night you spoke a little bit about the Vajrayana vows.
Ah, yes.
And that was of great interest to me because I've been wondering what I vowed to a number of years ago, because all I remember is you told me I was your slave forever. As your humble slave.
Could we start the evenings to talk over again? Okay.
But my a very real interest, because it's a commitment to approach daily life in a certain way.
Yeah.
You touched on that, and I'd like to, if there's more that you could say about it.
You remind me of my old office mate. We were driving to a friend's house for dinner. And I said, how do we get there? He said, you go along here until you get to the street and you turn left. And so I drove on for about half a mile, and I said, I don't think that street intersects this street. Can't just do what I say. Drive on, turn left. That's how he was. He said, so, I said, you know, I really don't think. I'm willing to bet you anything that it intersects. Now, just do it. Well, what are you willing? I'll be your slave for life. Done. And, of course, it didn't intersect. So he did end up as my slave for life. He was so angry. He hates to lose bets. After 3 years, this is right at the beginning of our officing together. At the end of the 3 year lease, we broke up the office and he went, do I have to still be your slave? So I did issue a declaration of emancipation. It's the easy way to answer this is to get very technical, so I'm trying not to do that. I think it's important to remember that. Much of what is talked about in spiritual practice, particularly when it comes to rituals and ceremonies, much is expressed in mythic and poetic language. And there's quite a famous saying. I'm not sure where it originates. When dreams become reality, disaster is not far behind. And the way this applies in spiritual practice is that whenever you try to make literal that which is expressed mythically, you end up with disaster. We've seen that time and again politically. Every time someone is declared to be the Messiah, in fact, it's usually is the beginning of a war. And a lot of people die. So, in the Vajrayana empowerment ritual, and if I were going to get technical, I would distinguish all the different levels of empowerments, but I'm not going to go there tonight. Student and teacher practice together. And in practicing together, they create the conditions in which, ideally, the student has some experience of what it means to be awake in the context of that particular yidam or deity. So, if it's Chenrezig, there's some sense of what it means to be the embodiment of awakened compassion. Or for White Tara or Green Tara, you know, Manjushri, different flavor, Vajrapani, quite a different flavor, and so forth. Uh, And a seed is planted, ideally, in the student's experience. That's the purpose of empowerment, really. It's carried out most times nowadays through a formal set of introductions, like, here's what it looks like, here's what it holds, you know, the Chenrezig, it's a crystal rosary and a lotus, so forth. And one holds these objects, and in holding that object, it's like, okay, lotus, rosary. What's that like? Now, usually it's just done so quickly and so formally that nothing much happens. And then at the end, there are these verses, the intention of which is to create within the student the conditions in which that seed can be nurtured and grow. You follow? So, one of those, conditions that helps that seed to grow is really being open to the teacher, and that's what's being expressed poetically. It's not literally, you know, being a slave. Even though that's actually how it's worded in some rituals. But it's an expression, a formalized expression of devotion on the part of the student, so that that devotion is instilled, because that devotion is, as we've been discussing last couple of days around positive emotions, I mean, when we bring that emotional energy in, as many of you have commented in the interviews that based on this discussion of working with faith, devotion, longing, etc., you find my practice is much more stable. My attention is just operates differently. That's those are the conditions. And so it's a formalized expression of that devotion with a view to planting that seed, so it's something that the student will maintain, and thus the seed of experience that has been planted can grow and blossom in the student. if you take a look at the mind training teachings, one of them, I think, is take care of what's important. Do you have a book here, Gail? No? Okay. Hard work at that commentary? Oh no, it's not. It's not. And one of the things that is important is one's relationship with one's teacher. So that's something that in that line of instruction, the student is being encouraged to take care of that relationship because it is so important. And I can certainly attest to the importance of taking care of it, because over the years I've been teaching, I've worked with at least a dozen people who've come to me because they felt something's broken down in their relationship with their teacher. And sometimes it's something the teacher has done, that the teacher's actually stepped out of the relationship. Sometimes it is the student has actually grown beyond that particular teacher. And sometimes it's the result of some misunderstanding between the teacher and student, which the student hasn't handled very well. And so it's given rise to a rupture. And in all cases, it affects the student's ability to practice very, very significantly. When there's an actual rupture in the relationship, what I've observed, it's usually 4 or 5 years before the student can practice again. It's very significant. In other circumstances, if it's handled the right way, then the transition can be much, much less than that. But even when it's the case of the student, the teacher having stepped out of the relationship for whatever reason, that can be very difficult because it can take quite a while for the student actually to accept that. When it's the case of the student growing to the point that they can't learn from that particular teacher, which isn't necessarily going beyond the teacher, but they can't learn from that particular teacher, then it's very tricky. It can be very tricky because often the teacher gets really defensive around that, and that's problematic. But that can usually be negotiated relatively smoothly. But in all of these cases, what I'm just trying to point out here is that the relationship between teacher and student is a very important part of one's practice, regardless, even leaving the whole devotion thing out of it. Within the Vajrayana, because there's very explicit recognition of that relationship, then care is taken in various formal ways to put in mechanisms which seek to protect the symbolic relationship between teacher and student from the inevitable foibles of the human relationship. And those lines at the end of the empowerment ceremony are very much in that spirit. Does that help?
Is there a place I can find those lines?
Yeah, I may have them with me. I'll have to check in my translation. Okay. And let's see. Let's see how much further I can dig myself into this one. Sure, I have this on this computer. That's the thing. To look. No, it doesn't seem I have. A little surprised. Let me try once more. No, I don't seem to have it with me.
I'll check with you at a later date.
Yeah, that's a little surprising. They've actually translated several of the empowerment ceremonies, but none of them seem to be here, which is a little bit worrying. But I did have a computer that was stolen from me several years ago. And I think I have them in hard copy somewhere. But I don't have them here.
Thank you.
Okay. Who's next?
I don't know which question to ask. You talked a little bit about the three commitments of Mahamudra. It's in stanza 13 of the Pith instruction.
Okay, yes, I know where we are now.
Can you flesh that out a little bit?
Yeah, it's a little obscure in there, isn't it?
No placement, no reference, no missing the point.
Yeah. Page 20.
And it also returns again on stanza 17. At least one of them does. Beyond any frame of reference, mind is naturally clear.
Yeah. Naropa studied with Tulopa for quite a while, and because Naropa was a brilliant scholar and a brilliant debater, and that was a very necessary skill to have in your monastery in those days, because if someone came to your monastery and challenged anybody in the monastery to debate, and you lost the debate, then everybody had to convert to that person's religion or practice, and they took over the monastery. So the stakes were very real. And Naropa was the guardian of one of the gates of, was it Nalanda or Vimala?
Nalanda.
So, you know, this meant he was damn good, because there's a lot of real estate and a lot of political power resting on his debating skills. So he's a little stuck in his head. Which is how he got to Tulopa. And Tulopa did one thing after another. And those of you who complain about me, I've only done this occasionally, but Tulopa did this quite frequently. The kind of thing that he would do is he'd see a pretty woman, like a princess being married in a marriage procession, and he would sort of say to Naropa, well, if I had a real student, he'd bring me that princess. And Naropa would maneuver his way through the crowds and then through the parading soldiers and pull the princess down from the elephant, and then security would but then the security was, you know, alerted, and they weren't too gentle in those days. And so there would be Naropa, you know, smashed and bruised and things like that. Tulopa would come over and say, are you suffering? Are you in pain? And Naropa would usually reply something along the lines, I cling to this body of flesh and blood. Yes, I'm in pain. And so the Lopa would do something to heal him and then give him instruction in the next thing. This went on through 12 hardships. There's a very important hidden message in these. The underlying message is pay attention to the body. Because it's never his spirit that is broken, it's his body that is broken. And he's having to relate to his body more and more. So finally, you know, he's wandering along with Talopa, and then there are a couple of vagabonds, homeless people just wandering around. And they come to a very little creek, you know, just a couple of feet wide. Something you could step over very easily. And Talopa says, if I really had a student, I wouldn't have to get my feet wet. And without any hesitation, Naropa throws himself down with his feet on one bank, his hands on the other bank, makes a human bridge. And Talopa starts to walk across, gets in the middle, and stops. And starts to jump up and down and dance. And there's Naropa hanging on. And his hand slips on the bank. And that side of the body tips. And the tip of Talopa's sandal gets wet. And Talopa immediately jumps on the bank, grabs Naropa, picks up his sandal and says, how dare you! You see, I'm not so bad. And Naropa wakes up. He's like, it's just there. And Talopa, of course, recognizes this and then sings this song for Naropa. Which is why it starts off with Mahamudra cannot be taught Naropa. See, he didn't try to teach him. He made him experience it. But your devotion to your teacher and the hardships you've met have made you patient in suffering and also wise. Take this to heart, my worthy student. Now, there's another important piece in that. It may not seem like it, but the teacher actually cares about the student. Just saying that. So, take this to heart, my worthy student. You can feel the gentleness in the words. So, verse 13. It helps if we go back to verse 12, because it goes together. Talopa has just gone through all of these different aspects of the metaphor of space. And that may be worth going through for ourselves also. And now he wants to caution Naropa about a few things. Don't forget, Naropa is a super scholar. He's really, really good. So in verse 12 he says, you don't see Mahamudra Shir clarity. You can translate that as experience. You won't experience Mahamudra Shir clarity by means of classical texts, philosophical systems, whether it's mantras, paramitas, vinaya, sutras or other collections. And those are short. That list there covers vast collections of different forms of Buddhist scriptures. So he's cautioning you, your way of working before may have made you brilliant and brought you all of this, but it's not going to help you here. He goes on. Ambition clouds sheer clarity and you don't see it. Now, isn't this really irritating? I have a friend who, a very, very bright guy, and he holds two PhDs, and he's a lecturer, professor at a university in Southern California, and very, very knowledgeable about an awfully wide range of things. And he went to see Munindra, who's the Theravadan teacher, about his practice. This is many years ago. And explained that he's having some problems in his practice. And Munindra listened patiently and then asked him two questions. Do you understand the principles of the Dharma and practice? And my friend said, yes. Because he did. Are you spiritually ambitious? And he said, yes. And Munindra just shook his head. What a pity. Ambition clouds sheer clarity, and you don't see it. Why? Because you're always looking beyond what you're experiencing to what you're going to experience or going to be. This is the Titan realm. So, for someone with Naropa's background, that's pretty hard stuff, because he'd reached the pinnacle of that. You know, he's the top dog in the Buddhist scholastic universe. And was top dog and top gun. He was installed in that position to protect. And then there's another issue or problem that arises. And this is particularly in... this tends to happen more in monastic practitioners, but it still does come up. I've seen it quite a lot in lay practitioners. And it can completely choke practice. And that is, you become obsessed with being utterly pure in your moral precepts. And it doesn't matter that text after text says, preserve your precepts absolutely purely, even at the cost of your life. You become obsessed with this. Now, in monasteries, well-established monasteries, when monks were newly ordained, there was always one or two of them that took their vows very seriously and, you know, were going to keep them absolutely purely, not only to the spirit but to the letter. And often they had, question marks about some of the senior monks who didn't seem to really appreciate what it means to practice mona purely. Now, in a well-run monastery, these highly ambitious monks would be given to a senior person who would literally beat this nonsense out of them. You find the same thing actually in the rules of Saint Benedict. Because it's very, very well established that the people who are most rigid about their ordination are the most likely to break it. Yeah. So thinking about precepts undermines the point of commitment. Why? you take these precepts in order to create the conditions within oneself for fruitful practice. And when you are obsessed with observing the letter of the precepts, this gets in the way of just resting clear, open, present. Because you're always thinking, did I do that right? Did I do that right? Someone becomes one's own harshest critic, and the critic never shuts up, and it just goes on and on and on. This isn't so good for one's practice. So, do not think about anything. Let all ambition drop. Much better if you're doing a 6 month retreat, then this one would really bite. You know? Just like, what am I going to achieve in this retreat? Nothing. Can we review the terms, please? Let what arises settle by itself like patterns in water. A metaphor which many of you are familiar with. No place, no focus, no missing the point. Now, this was an informal song. We don't know the Sanskrit to this, or Prakrit, or whatever language. Tulopa was speaking when he sang the song. Afterwards, Naropa apparently went back and wrote it down. And some years later, when Marpa the translator was studying with Naropa, this was one of the things that Naropa pulled out and said, you know, by the way, here's the song from Tulopa, and gave it to Marpa. And Marpa translated it into Tibetan. And that's there are two different versions of with the order of the verses, somewhat different, but
that one in Sanskrit and one in
Tibetan. No, two in Tibetan, with the order of the verses quite different. There isn't a Sanskrit copy of this, and no. There are two Tibetan versions in the Kanjur, but I don't know of any Sanskrit copy. So. Tulopa, because he was singing and it was an impromptu song, was taking certain liberties with language and saying things poetically. But we have in No Place, No Focus, No Missing the Point, in somewhat different language, the three key instructions of Mahamudra in the Kagyu tradition. No distraction, no control, no working at anything. No distraction, no control, no working at anything. Now, that's my translation. You will generally hear it translated as no distraction or no wandering. No contrivance is how it's usually translated, but when I've thought about what does this mean, why do we try to contrive our experience? We're trying to control our experience. So I prefer to put it into more everyday English, and that's no control. And then the last one is no meditating. No meditating. but the word for meditation in that case is familiarizing yourself with something. It's the process of becoming familiar with something. It's the usual word for meditation in the Tibetan tradition. But it has this idea of working at something. So that's why I translate it as working at something.
But the first one, no place.
Just a second. I'm only halfway through. Now, no place basically corresponds to the last one. No working at anything. There's in the Tibetan there is mene, which is or neme or something. I'll have to look it up. But it's the idea. I mean, there's this idea in meditation of placing the mind. You're doing something. You're placing the mind. Nope. No place. And just think about that for a minute. You sit down, and you don't do anything with your mind. How many of you would like to practice that way? Hands up, come on. You know, it's like, what? Yeah, okay. No focus. Well, that would be the second one. No contrivance or no control. You aren't focusing on anything. So you don't do anything. You don't focus on anything. It's getting a little strange, isn't it? Okay. Well, of course, yes. And now the killer. Don't miss the point. There's a story told of Gurdjieff in Moscow. And he had a group of people that studied with him. And he was a very difficult teacher to study with, always doing unpredictable things and challenging people in different ways. And he wrote three books. One of them called All and Everything, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. And the book is absolutely unreadable. And that's the point of the book. You know, because you get these sentences which go on and on and on and say absolutely nothing, though they seem to be saying something. And the book itself is, reading it is the practice. Because you just, by the end of it, you just can't hold on to anything. You know, this whole idea of trying to understand something, it's gone. Needless to say, people have been trying to understand and write commentaries on it, etc., etc. Anyway, Gurdjieff would have these working sessions which were intensely serious, in which he would read excerpts from this. And everybody would be sitting around. Really, I mean, because they had worked with focusing attention in different ways. Very, very serious. One of these, a woman at the other end of the table, listening to Gurdjieff reading this, found herself wanting to laugh. And everybody's sitting. And she's in there. And finally she couldn't contain it. She just burst out laughing. And everybody froze. They're already pretty still, but now they froze. There is this dead silence. Gurdjieff looked up, glowered at everybody, which he was very good at doing. One person got the point. So, you keep that in mind, Larry. No missing the point. Okay. That's no wandering. No distraction. You do nothing with your mind, you don't focus on anything, and you don't miss the point. That's pretty straightforward, isn't it? Oh, yes, one line. Do not break this commandment. It is the light in the dark. Next. You have another question? Microphone.
does it require a wise general to end the war and all the skirmishes? And where does that leave the fool?
What are you asking?
I'm asking if it requires a general, a wise general, to end the war.
Ah, I see.
And all of the skirmishes associated with that war.
Yeah.
And where does that leave the fool?
Where does that leave the fool? Well, in this particular war, can you bring in a wise general?
There are very few.
Yeah, but suppose, well, three or four right here. Are they any use to you? Any use to you?
As an exemplar. As someone that is demonstrating it's possible.
When you're in hand-to-hand combat with forces that outnumber, is it helpful to think of a wise general?
You're saying get real and now.
Well, it all takes place right here in our own experience.
Right.
We can study all we want. We can think about it. We can come to a very sophisticated understanding. That may or may not be helpful when it comes to dealing with our own mind.
That's why I'm asking about the fool.
What does the identity serve?
Pardon?
What does the identity of the fool serve in you?
Going around in circles in countless
situations. No, that's maybe the behavior, etc., etc. What does it serve to regard yourself as a fool?
As compared with the general, the wise general, who's been able to end the war and all the skirmishes.
Do you see yourself as a wise general?
No.
Do you see yourself as a fool?
More on that end of the continuum.
What does that serve?
Well, it served many things.
I'm listening.
I mean, through life, We all.
No, we're talking about here at these wars. What
through,
does it say?
Through life, being a fool has had a purpose.
Yeah, I'm asking what purpose? How does it serve you?
It's had the purpose of telling the truth at times when people didn't want to hear it.
Okay. Is that useful to you in these skirmishes, in this war?
No, that's what I'm saying.
So maybe the first step is to let go of the fool.
Well, that can be done.
Okay.
Now, can we go back to the war and the skirmishes?
And what would you like to know about the war and the skirmishes?
I would like to know if one can win the war and end this, and all of the skirmishes. Or is ending the war dealing with skirmish after skirmish after skirmish?
Today, after the afternoon meditation, we read the uh, 37 practices of a bodhisattva. Page 37, verse 20. If you don't subdue the opponent inside, your own anger, although you subdue opponents outside, they just keep coming. Muster the forces of loving kindness and compassion, and subdue your own mind. This is the practice of a bodhisattva.
Thank you. It sounds like skirmishes to me.
Okay. Anybody else? Jeff.
I was curious about that. Muster the forces of loving kindness and compassion and subdue. A really interesting combination of words there.
Well, Tome Zongpo, as the author of this, is using a metaphor. A metaphor of war forces. Most of you here, perhaps everyone here, knows what this looks like in actual practice. Suppose there's some anger in this. Now, if I impose loving kindness and compassion on that anger, which would be taking this metaphor literally, muster the forces of loving kindness and compassion and subdue your own mind, right? Reminds me of honored Christian soldiers or something. How does that work, Jeff?
You just get more and more pissed off.
Yeah, because basically you're forcing something into repression and pushing on resistance, and it just becomes stronger and stronger. So what do you actually do?
What I've noticed myself doing at times without thinking about it is being aware of the other's position.
Yeah.
Situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so the anger's there, but it's not expressed.
But I'm going to work more internally than that. There's the anger in you. What if you greet that anger with loving kindness? It goes back to something Christy raised a couple of nights ago. Remember, I think it was Bell Hooks who studied with Thupten Jinpa. And one day she was just really, really angry about something. And it showed in her body. And Thupten Jinpa came up beside her, whispered in her ear, "Buddha mind very angry today."
And she smacked him.
No, she didn't actually. He was more skilled than that. But you greet the anger with loving kindness. What happens? Your own anger with loving kindness.
I'm looking at this through, I did for quite some time try to work with the joy. I'm angry and I'm glad.
Yeah.
It's like throwing gas on the fire.
I can see that.
So I could see that the loving kindness might be a...
But I mean,
I find it more.
Just what does it feel like when I just throw out that image?
To me, it feels like another one of those shoulds that I would utterly fail
yeah.
at. That it would be a lot better simply to greet it with no agenda.
So equanimity instead.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's fair enough. But, you know, I'm just going to push you a little bit here. Let's forget about the shoulds. I just want you to explore actually doing it. No shoulds here. There's that anger. And you feel warmth towards the anger.
It works.
Pardon?
It works.
What happens? For the benefit of others.
Joy.
Okay. It's difficult for it to hold, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just...
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So, when we read verses such as this... Again, it's poetry, it's mythic language. You interpret it literally. I got 10,000 troops of loving kindness here. We're going to stomp over that anger stuff. Dismantle the city of anger. It's not going to work very well. But the poetry is saying, engage. Engage your experience. Whatever it is. You've got this anger in you? Engage it. How do you engage it? Engage it with loving kindness and compassion. Engage it that way. It's very important to read these as poetry. Do you follow?
Yes.
Does it help?
Yeah, I mean, it's thematic with what's been coming up the last couple of days with bringing emotion into practice.
Yeah.
Instead of holding it in attention, you know, something that was sort of cold and clear like that. This is different.
Yeah. That's exactly. Thank you. Okay. All right. Other questions? Claudia. Oh, other direction.
Last night, you were talking to Carolyn, and you mentioned that there were a number of texts that help with transitioning.
Oh. Yeah,
are they available in English? And
oh,
could you share them with us?
Yeah, this groundlessness stuff, right? This groundlessness stuff. Yeah.
There's a number of us in the room interested.
Tao Te Ching is pretty good. The Tao Te Ching. Did I? No, I didn't bring it this evening. Nope. It's there's a lot of good, helpful stuff in that. The two I'm reading right now, I was reading three, but I've let one of them go. One is Red Pines, and Red Pine is primarily a writer and an academic. But he's very sensitive to nuances in Chinese because he knows Chinese very, very well. That I find that in terms of I find that his translation of the Tao Te Ching brings out the meditative aspects of the Tao Te Ching actually, quite clearly sometimes. Maybe I'm just projecting into it, but that's what it does for me. A lot of it is symbolically expressed, and I won't claim that I understand all of it, because I don't. I haven't studied anything like sufficient depth. But there's certain things that just jump out, and I go, that's neat, I like that, and so forth. The other one that I'm reading is Ursula Le Guin. I didn't know that she had that level of expertise. I know her as a science fiction writer, and she writes really interesting stuff. But I like the poetry of her translation, and in terms of how does this manifest in action, she's a bit stronger on that way, a bit clearer about like what does it look like in the world. I was reading Cleary's, and Cleary's just translated volumes and volumes. But as I look at these translations more closely. You can tell that Cleary's just grinding it out. And he's pretty good at grinding it out, but it doesn't have the same level of refinement as is evident in Ursula Le Guin's and Red Pines. George introduced me to another translation, which I've only taken a short look at. It's the one he likes best because it's as enigmatic in English as it is in Chinese. And the translator, I can't remember the name of the translator, that was his intention, is that the English should be as enigmatic as the Chinese, which is a very good way to translate if you feel you're up to it. So it's a very demanding way to translate. There are many others, but those are the ones that I'm most familiar with. Okay? When things fall away, you find yourself grasping at ghosts. Right? And like any self-respecting ghost, you know, just slips through your fingers. What one keeps forgetting, perhaps, is the freedom in that. Most of the time you think, I can't take hold of anything. But there's freedom in that. So, one way to proceed here is to explore the freedom. And how willing ears did that fall? But one can go a little further, perhaps. There's a saying I came across. I think I was reading a book on translation from Spanish into English. And apparently it's a very common phrase in Mexico, but I hadn't heard it before. The devil knows a lot more from being old than from being the devil. When things fall away, there's not only freedom, there's also clarity. You just see how things work. There are a couple of hits involved with that. It's death to idealization, etc. But at the same time, there's the potential for great capability because you see how things work. And to a significant extent, you're no longer attached to wanting things to be a certain way. And that allows one to navigate the world differently. Again, from the Taoist tradition, Zhuangzi, was approached by two ministers, emissaries from the emperor, and asked to come to court to be an advisor to the emperor. And Zhuangzi demurred. And the emissaries assured him that he would have an exalted position, he would have a high rank, he would have beautiful clothes, etc. The emperor would take his counsel seriously, etc., etc. And after listening to this for a while, Zhuangzi said to the emissaries, I hear the emperor has this very ancient and revered tortoise, or turtle, that is placed in this beautiful wooden box with very delicate cushioning, and his shell is encrusted with jewels. And the emissaries said, yes, that's true. Between you and me, said Zhuangzi, do you think the turtle prefers the box or the mud at the bottom of the river? And the emissaries said, the mud at the bottom of the river. And Zhuangzi said, let me stay in the mud. The freedom comes because many of the things that we may have striven for in our lives, and for which many people do strive, no longer hold meaning. And thus, we can operate in situations without the usual expectations or drives or concerns. And it makes a difference. This help? Yeah. So. Okay. Other questions? Paul.
So this past year, there's my sangha. Some people kind of projected onto me, and created some difficulty for.
What kind of thing they project on?
Well, for some reason, I'm seen as a more senior person in my.
Oh, life. I see.
I said, I'm seen as a more experienced person in my sangha.
They put you on a pedestal.
Yeah.
You get a great view from up there, don't you?
So I have come a long way in dealing with my side of it, I think. But I'm just wondering if you have any insight into if there's any possibility of prevention and minimizing that or dealing with it when it comes up.
How serious are you about this, Paul?
Pretty serious.
And then let me tell you this story. And you can tell me if or how it might fit. A dervish approached the master and said, I'm a little concerned. People are starting to approach me to teach, and they're listening to what I say. I'm not terribly comfortable with this. What should I do about it? And the teacher said, do two or three things that are just completely crazy and make no sense whatsoever. And the dervish said, but what will people think of me then? And the master said, very interesting. I thought this was a question about your discomfort with being a teacher, but I see it's really a question about how people regard you.
I don't have a... What comes to mind immediately when you say that is a worry about hurting people. Because...
I didn't say hurt them. I said do something completely crazy. That's what the I didn't say anything. That's what the teacher said in the story. I didn't say about hurting. Just, you know, dye your hair green and wear a fur skin to the next time you go and speak. Pardon?
High heels.
High heels.
And carry an umbrella. There is some
chance after that they'll all show up at Green Heron.
But I did this at a retreat.
You did that?
Yeah. The suit was great. The suit just freaked everybody out.
Well, you see how he's dressed right now.
Give him the mic.
I mean, this is standard fare for Ken MacLeod, right? You know, we don't even notice what he's wearing because it's always khaki pants and usually a blue shirt.
And don't forget my hoodie.
Yeah, same hoodie. And he has the same sweater he wears all the time, too.
Totally nondescript.
So, in the middle of this retreat, he walks in for the teaching in a business suit.
Oh, come on. It was a double-breasted Italian suit. It wasn't any
Maybe
ordinary business
to go
suit.
To the opera or something.
Very nice tie.
But we just sat there. Like, stunned.
And they had to listen to the teaching, too.
And then the next night, I can't even remember what you wore, but it
No, the next night was the hat.
Oh, that's right, the hat.
Yeah, with Roger, right?
Yeah.
Roger finally took care of it.
No, but he did. Kind of top all of it with this wild outfit when he walked in the last one. I can't even remember what it was now.
Yeah, but it was a red wig.
Yeah, it was a red wig. Yeah.
Nice long hair. Pardon?
It was fuzzy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just things that just didn't match at all. And then I gave him pointing out instructions. Oh, crazy wisdom is a...
No, it had actually a profound effect because any expectations that we had around him just fell away. And we were in a state of...
Shock.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an empty place. It's just like anything else when it falls away and you're just there and it's like, And then he gets pointing out instructions.
So it worked very well. So, Paul, what do you have to say?
Well, since I wasn't there, I don't know, you know, necessarily... how it felt to everyone, but you know, people could just think of it as a joke.
But why are you concerned about what people think?
No,
your concern is to get off the pedestal.
But if it's just a joke, then it won't actually. I don't think it would actually dismantle that idea.
Oh, you want to be more effective? You want to make sure? I suggest you wear a tux. Sit down, meditate.
Okay, well...
The thing is, okay, so here are these suggestions. What's it running into in you?
I don't think it'll work.
Even Charles is shaking his head, so...
People just ask me, what's the deal? Or
and you just say, I just felt like wearing this tonight. No explanation. Or you say, what are you talking about? Well, you're wearing this. Yeah, so what?
I think that would totally backfire.
Pardon?
I think that would totally backfire.
Well, I can give it a try, see what happens.
Okay. But there are other things you can do. When they ask you a question, say something that is totally, completely, utterly wrong.
Yeah, you need us to
You know? How do you practice meditation? Well, it's really important to sit absolutely as rigidly still as possible. Yeah, let's try that. Really still. What's it running into?
They know it's a joke.
No, that's not what's running into in you. What's it running into in you?
I've said things like that before, just as a joke. So
yes, but now you're saying I'm dead serious. Don't forget, your intention here is to get off the pedestal. The only way you can get off the pedestal is by breaking the projections. The only way you can break the projections is to do something that violates the projections.
Okay, that's helpful.
Of course they'll come up with new projections.
Are you concerned about not meeting their expectations?
Not really.
Okay. So, there was a person I studied with, in Orange County, an attorney, who had actually an MBA law degree and a degree in psychology, very well educated, and he was part of a men's group. And because he had such breadth of learning and experience, he was kind of one of the senior people, and everybody looked to him for sage advice, etc., etc. And I was working with him on breaking the social contract. So we figured, rather than his family or his legal profession, this would be a good area to start working on breaking the social contract, breaking up these projections. So I told him, yeah, break the projections here. It took him several months. And he found that when he tried to do something which was different from this image or the identity that he had in this group, it was just really difficult. But eventually an occasion arose. And there was a young man in the group who was recounting something quite painful. And my student chose this moment to say something utterly stupid and inappropriate. And he managed to get out of his mouth. And everybody in the group immediately got really angry with him. And all connected with this young man. And so it turned into this wonderful bonding experience for this young man with all of these older men taking care of him. And you know what happened next? They all turned to my student and said, "That was brilliant."
Yeah. The way this one projection happened is that one person thought I should uphold the precepts 100% perfect, and I didn't. To break that projection, it would seem like I would have to break a precept, which I'm not interested in doing.
Sounds like you've already broken it in his or her eyes.
Yeah, well, that's already done, but, I mean, for future...
Yeah, well, okay. But you don't have to break a precept. You just have to do something completely that doesn't make any sense. You could take this as an exercise in creativity.
Yeah, I mean, I generally don't have a problem with breaking people's expectations of me.
But you do in this circumstance.
I'm usually trying to do that all the time, but as far as I knew before, but it's kind of surprised me. So in general, I try to break people's expectations. It might be its own problem in itself, but
all right. Okay, let's do some meditation together. Tomorrow, I think we'll talk about space.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.